Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crowntown, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, we're going deep on something that's been lurking around the edges of our conversations and needs to be unpacked more. We're talking about the aura of art and what happens to presence when everything becomes copyable. According to Walter Benjamin, we're going to look at Byzantine icons, blockchain tokens, and AI image generators. This is the episode where Jewish futurism gets into the soul of the object and the ethics of art. Let's get into it, y'all. So I want to start us off by taking you back to one of my college classrooms of my past. I don't exactly remember the year, but I vaguely remember my haircut, but I definitely remember this feeling. My professor assigned us an essay by a German philosopher named Walter Benjamin. The essay was called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, and it was written in 1936. I read it, and I didn't fully get it. The language was pretty dense, but Benjamin had these arguments that kind of kept gesturing at something that I could sense, but I couldn't really name it. So I wrote something for class, I turned it in, and I moved on to other projects. But here's the thing about Benjamin's work, is it doesn't just stay turned in a paper. It keeps popping its head back up. I have returned to that essay at almost every significant turning point of my life as an artist and a thinker. When I first started working with Jewish cultural objects, when the internet changed how I related to my own work online, when I started using AI tools in my studio process, every single one of those times, Benjamin was already there waiting with something more to say. So today, I want to walk you through what he actually argued, what it means, and then take it somewhere he never could have, because he died in 1940, before most of what I'm going to talk about even existed. Let me start with Benjamin's core idea. He said that every original artwork had what he called an aura. He defined it as the unique presence of an artwork in both time and space. It's irreplaceable here and now. And he said, and this is the part that hit me the hardest when I actually finally understood it, even the most perfect reproduction of a work of art is lacking one thing, its existence at the specific place where it happens to be. Now, I want to stop right there because I think there's a tendency to read this as being romantic, like Benjamin is just being precious about original art. But he is not being romantic, he's being precise. And the best way to feel what he means is to think about your own life. Think about a time you stood in front of something that actually stopped and moved you. Maybe it was a painting in a museum, maybe it was a building, maybe it was a religious object, something your family has had for generations. Maybe it was a live performance where the room went completely silent with how beautiful the music was. You know the feeling I'm describing. Something is present in that moment that cannot be transferred to something else. You could photograph it, record it, describe it, and none of those things would carry what you actually felt standing there. Benjamin called that the presence of aura. And he spent his career asking what happens to it when technology makes everything reproducible. So let's talk a little bit about what aura actually is. So Benjamin said that aura is made up of three ingredients. The first is authenticity, the work's embeddedness in a specific historical moment and place. A painting doesn't just exist in the present time. It actually exists at the end of a long chain of moments, each one leaving its mark on the image. Who made it? When? Under what conditions? Who owned it after that? What rooms has it been hung in? What survived and what didn't? All of that accumulates in the object itself. The original carries that history and the copy does not. The second ingredient is ritual origin. Benjamin makes this fascinating argument that the oldest artworks were not made to be displayed or appreciated aesthetically. They were made purely for ceremony, for magic, prayer. A carved figure deep in a cave was not there for decoration. It was an instrument of ritual. And even as art secularized, even as it moved from temples into galleries, it never fully shed the ritual dimension. He calls the reverence people feel in front of art a secularized ritual, a cult of beauty. Y'all, this is where it gets very Jewish futurism-y for me, because we already know that. We live this. A Torah scroll is not primarily a text to be read silently. It is dressed. It is paraded. It is touched with a yod pointer. It is returned then to the ark with song. The ritual is inseparable from the object. That is cult value in its purest form. A Hanukkah, an eight-branched menorah that has been in a family for four generations, is not the same object as the same identical type, right? The same one, but bought last year. It carries a history in its scratches and its dents. Benjamin was describing something our tradition has always understood, and he understood it too. The third ingredient is distance. Benjamin describes aura as a unique phenomena of distance, however close it might be. What he means is that the object holds you at its arm's length. It cannot be fully consumed or possessed. There is always a gap between you and it. And that gap is not frustration, it's the experience itself. Now, here's what photography did to all three of those ingredients. When photography arrived in the mid-19th century, Benjamin says it did something no previous technology had done. It didn't just copy artworks. It detached them from the tradition that they were embedded in. Think about this. A photograph of the Mona Lisa can be printed into a textbook in Tokyo and on a postcard in Paris and a coffee mug in a Charlotte gift shop, all at the same time. The image is everywhere. The painting, though, is still only in the Louvre. But now you've probably seen the image hundreds of times before you would ever even stand in front of the original. When you do stand in front of it, there's this weird, strange, flattening feeling that I've heard people report. The reproduction has certainly colonized the original in that way. Benjamin called this the waning of the aura. The three ingredients, authenticity, ritual, origin, distance, all get eroded by the logic of mechanical reproduction. The copy breaks the chain of history. It removes the ritual context, and it collapses the distance. Now, here's where Benjamin gets really interesting and where I think people often misread him. I certainly did. He was not just mourning this loss. He saw something potentially liberating in it too. If art was no longer locked inside palaces and churches and the reverence of the elite, maybe it could become something more democratic. Film especially excited him. A film could be seen by millions of people at once. No grand pilgrimage needed. I find that honesty in him really valuable, because most people, when they engage with questions about technology and culture, fall into one of two camps. Either everything new is progress and nostalgic people just really need to get over it, or everything new is degradation and we're losing something irreplaceable. Benjamin doesn't do either. He sits within the tension. As someone who thinks about Jewish futurism, that posture feels deeply familiar. We are always holding tradition and transformation at the same time. Now, here's something that I didn't know long time ago that I can now appreciate, is that Benjamin had an interest in Kabbalah. He was not a mystic, he was not a rabbi, but he did spend most of his life trying to translate religious and theological intuitions into the language of materialism and history. He wanted his ideas to hold up in secular terms, and at that time in Marxist terms, in terms that did not require you to believe in God to follow the argument. But here's the thing about growing up inside of a tradition as rich and as strange as Jewish mysticism. Even when you leave the vocabulary behind, the deep structure comes with you. The way you see the world, the problems you think are worth solving, the kind of answers that feel satisfying, all that gets shaped by the traditions, whether you announce it or not. Happens to be that Gershom Scholem, one of his closest friends, and the man who knew that his thinking better than most anyone alive, said something close to this. Scholem believed that Benjamin's most original ideas were essentially secularized mysticism. Jewish theological categories that had shed their explicit religious vocabulary, but kept their deep structure intact. The sparks were still there. They were just wearing different clothes. One more thing about this before I move on. Benjamin noticed something beautiful and devastating in early photography. He said that the portrait of a dead loved one was the last refuge of cult value. The human face in an early daguerreotype still carries something irreducible, a grief, a particularity, a presence that no mechanical process can fully erase. Even in the technology that destroyed Aura, one fragment of it held on in the face of someone who's passed. I've thought about that observation more times than I can count, and it led me to really think about this value map, right? Of like, how could we think about Benjamin's value declarations of cult and exhibition and think about how that's endured through time. So he starts off with these two poles of value, cult value on one end and exhibition value on the other. But here's what I want to do is to add to his framework, because Benjamin died in 1940, and there's been four more technological eras since then. Each one generated a new kind of way of thinking about value that he may or may not have anticipated. So let's walk through those. So in the first era, which is before the camera, we receive cult value, right, according to Benjamin. This is sacred, singular, embedded in ritual. You had to travel to it. The gap between you and the object was the point. And I want to be clear, this has not disappeared from contemporary practice at all. Studio artists working in slow, material-intensive disciplines, oil painting, ceramics, printmaking, still generate genuine aura through the ritual of making, for sure. The visible trace of time in an object, the irreproducible encounter with an original surface, these conditions still produce something real. Cult value is not dead by any means. It's just no longer the only game in town. So that takes us to the next era, when photography and mechanical reproduction introduced exhibition value, according to Benjamin. Art detaches tradition and travels to you now. It's flattened and portable, way more democratic. But the form of that access has changed. The market fought back almost immediately with signed editions, numbered prints, certificates of authenticity. The demand for aura went underground and started looking for new containers. The pattern repeats in every era that follows, and once you see it, you cannot unsee it. So transitioning to the digital age, where now we see manipulation value. So according to the theorist Lev Manovich, he argued in 1998 that the database replaced narrative as the dominant logic of digital culture. In a database, everything becomes a node waiting to be queried, remixed, recombined, non-linear form. Art becomes raw material, and hip-hop is the richest expression of this logic in the 20th century. Joseph Schloss, in his book Making Beats, shows that producers sample not because it's convenient, but because it's beautiful, governed by a strict ethic of reverence for the source. When Madlib samples a 1972 soul record, he's folding the aura of that original session into something new. The manipulation is also an act of love. He's present to what he borrowed. He's accountable to it. That accountability is everything. And I'll come back to why about that in a minute. The next era is the era of social media. And we now have something that is of circulation value. What an artwork is worth now is inseparable from how far and how fast it moves. A work that reaches 10 million people acquires authority that has nothing to do with singularity. Art now risks losing significance not by being too widely produced, but by not being reproduced widely enough. Obscurity becomes a threat, not ubiquity. That is a complete inversion of everything Benjamin's framework assumed, and I find that genuinely disorienting, and this has been my experience. In the fifth era, folks attempted to make NFTs into digital scarcity. So when digital technology made reproduction totally free and infinite, the market took an art project by Mr. McCoy and built a financial instrument out of it to simulate the feeling of the original, a blockchain certificate, a token. A critic named Lori Rojas put it well, NFTs don't reinvent the aura, they show us what it always was, a structure of power, hierarchy, and exclusivity dressed in spiritual language. The desire for the original is real. The container is synthetic. A certificate of authenticity is not an aura. It is the ghost of aura, wearing a financial instrument as a costume. Oof, that is an intense feeling. And that brings us to AI generation, right? Now something has generative value. Okay, this is where it gets personal. So I have fine-tuned image models on my own artwork. I fed them my visual language, my aesthetic history, right? Lots of eras of work, and written all the prompts. Every image needs a prompt. So you have to write that out and are just all captured into these series of image models. And I watched them after I was able to use them, generate images that look in some meaningful way, like my work. It's like looking in a mirror that has learned your face, but doesn't know your name. It's like a little creepy. The outputs are genuinely useful. I can really use them for ideation, for unlocking directions I might not have found or seen on my own otherwise. And I want to be honest about that because I think a lot of artists are having this experience and are feeling uncertain about how to actually talk about that. You know, these tools work and that's real. So, you know, finding your limit, finding out what's ethical, that's an important thing. And it's important to say that I've not used AI output in any of my final artwork. Something stops me like every single time. Just when I think, oh, well, that's technically mine. Then I'm like, well, no, because my model that I used is fine-tuned. It's not trained purely on my artwork, right? It's the small model, 0.5 diffusion, stable diffusion, but it's still trained on artwork. I can't verify if it's copyright-free or not. So I don't ever use it in that way. Who knows? Maybe in the future, if I can fully train a model of my own, I might do it. That could be cool. Here's what I think that something is that stops me is the generated image carries the shape of my aura, but never its weight. The model learned from objects that I've made in historic specific moments. It was not there when I made them. There was no, you know, working with materials. No decisions made under pressure, no specific afternoon in a specific part of my studio where, you know, something got resolved. Aura of my source work, like, doesn't transfer over. It was sampled, average, and extrapolated into something that looks like me from the outside, but is not me at all on the inside. Now, here's where collage comes in as a useful contrast and perhaps a logic we can use to see this a little bit further. So Hannah Hoch, Kurt Schwitters, and Romare Bearden, these artists built entire practices on deliberately cutting apart source materials, and yet their works carry unmistakable aura of their own. The cut is a decision. The placement of the cut is a decision. The tension between fragments is authored and lived. AI image generation looks like collage from the outside, but the difference is exactly what Benjamin would have named. There is no hand, no moment, and no resistance from materials. A collage artist is accountable to their source. An AI model was never present to the wholeness of what it actually borrowed from. And that is where this gets very Jewish futurism-y, because there is actually a value type in AI that is structurally close to something in Jewish textual tradition. A 2025 paper in the Leonardo Journal calls it generative value. The artwork's worth measured not by its moment of creation, but by how much potential it has. How many futures can it produce? An AI model is a generative system. Its value is promissory, oriented towards futures rather than anchored in a singular past or a moment. And y'all, this is how Jewish textual tradition works. The Torah is not a fixed artifact to just be contemplated. It's a generative system to be interpreted, argued with, extended, and returned to across generations. The Talmud is not a closed document. It's an open argument. The value lives in the future it keeps producing, not the singular moment of its creation. So here's the tension I'm sitting with as a Jewish futurist. Generative value and cult value structurally opposite in almost every way. One is tied to presence, singularity, and the irreplaceable moment. The other is oriented towards variation, potential, and futures. And yet they share one remarkable thing. Neither is reducible to display. Neither is fully captured by the logic of exhibition. Both require something more from us. I don't have a clean resolution to that tension, but I think naming it clearly is the first step. So why does any of this matter? Here's what I keep coming back to with this after all this stuff that I'm talking about. The desire for aura in art never disappears. Every single technological shift we've talked about today triggers an almost immediate cultural attempt to reconstruct what was just lost. Sign prints after photography, authentication certificates in the digital age, blockchain tokens after infinite reproducibility, the slow craft revival right now, the vinyl resurgence of record players, young artists shooting on celluloid actual film. These are not nostalgic accidents. They are symptoms of a persistent human need for the irreplaceable encounter, for the object or experience that can not be anywhere else because it's only here and now. I see this in my students. I see this in collectors. I see it in myself every time I walk into a room with an object that stops me cold. The need is real. What changes is only the form it takes and how honestly we reckon with whether the form we found is actually delivering what we're hungry for. Does it work or does it not work? Is the artwork speaking to you or is it not? That's the question. So where I want to leave y'all with is not whether aura survives. It clearly does in some form in every era. The question is, what conditions make genuine aura possible and what conditions produce only its simulation? The handmade object, the live performance, the face-to-face encounter, the ritual object that has been somewhere and surviving something, these still generate something real. The blockchain certificate, the AI output, the viral image, these generate something that rhymes with aura but plays by different rules. Knowing the difference and caring about the difference is something I think about as an artist, as a designer, and honestly, as someone who thinks a lot about what Jewish material culture is and what it is for. Walter Benjamin died in 1940 at the Spanish border, fleeing the Nazis. He took his own life rather than be captured and sent back. He was Jewish, and that was enough to make everything he had built, every idea he had spent his life developing, a target. He was carrying a manuscript in his bag that night. No one has ever found it. Whatever it contained, it went with him to the grave. I think about that a lot. Here was a man who spent his entire career thinking about what gets lost when things are reproduced, when presents get scattered, when the vessel breaks. And then the vessel broke. His life, his final manuscript, his physical presence in the world, gone, scattered. The Nazis did to Benjamin exactly what mechanical reproduction does to aura. They destroyed the original and left nothing behind. And yet here we are, still reading him, still pulled back to the same essay he wrote in 1936, still finding in his fragments something that illuminates exactly the moment we are living in. That is what Gershom Scholem would have called the nitzotz, divine sparks, refusing to be extinguished even after the vessel shatters. Benjamin, the man, died at the border. Benjamin, the thinker, keeps crossing borders he never lived to see. He did not live to see television, or the internet, or the smartphone, or the AI image generator trained on someone else's life's work. But he understood the essential dynamic that drives all of them. Every new technology promises to bring art closer to everyone. And every new technology changes what art is in the process of doing. Those two things are both true and in permanent tension. This is the Shevarit Hekalim playing out in every era. The light tries to fill the vessel. The vessel shatters. The sparks scatter further. And somewhere, someone tries to gather them. The question he asked in 1936 is the same one I keep asking in my studio right here, and in my classroom, and honestly, at 3 a.m. when I can't sleep. Was anyone present when this was made? That's a great question. Ask it about everything. I don't have a settled answer, but I think it is the right question. And the fact that a Jewish man fleeing for his life in 1940, carrying ideas that could not be destroyed even when he was, left us exactly this question to sit with. That feels like tikkun to me. That feels like a spark that made it through. I'm glad I keep returning to it. Thanks, y'all. This has been the Jewish Futurism Lab with Mike Wirth. Until next time, keep dreaming.